Strangers, this is part 2 of 2. If you didn't listen to last week's episode, go back and do that now, otherwise you're going to be really confused. But here's a quick refresher. In the wee morning hours of July 4th, 1954, Dr. Sam Shepard, a young, successful doctor living on Lake Erie in Ohio, called police to report that his pregnant wife, Marilyn Shepard, had been bludgeoned to death in her bed. The coroner, Dr. Daniel Gerber, took control of the investigation and within 12 hours had decided Dr. Shepard had killed his wife despite any evidence supporting this claim. After a hasty inquest, arrest, and grand jury trial, Dr. Sam Shepard found himself back in jail after making bail, awaiting an actual trial by jury. Unfortunately, the media would have their trial first. Can we mere humans ever really separate out our personal opinions and biases from cold, hard facts? Once our minds are made up, or at least influenced by outside forces, can we really ever be impartial? How can someone ever hope to get a fair trial if the person heading up the investigation apparently has an axe to grind? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I'm someone who would not make a good juror because I tend to be pretty judgy. But at least I can admit that. The same, it seems, cannot be said for others. Not all, of course, but there are plenty of people, from law enforcement to forensic scientists to prosecutors to jurors and the press, who cannot seem to keep their opinions and judgments out of their roles. When the law says you're innocent until proven guilty, everyone involved in bringing the case to justice should be as dispassionate as possible. Unfortunately, humans tend to be, well, human. And even when we think we're traveling light, with our opinions and such, we're actually carrying all of our baggage around with us wherever we go. But even if all 12 of your fellow citizens sitting on the jury in your trial really are able to keep their own opinions out of their decision, they're still relying on information from many seen and unseen actors who may not have been as impartial. You better hope you didn't piss one of those people off somewhere along the way. Now, if you remember, we're talking about Dr. Sam Shepard, the osteopath/neurosurgeon charged with killing his pregnant wife, Marilyn, inside of their fancy lakefront Ohio home. Shepard's trial began in October of 1954, and, well, let's just say Lady Justice's scales weren't exactly balanced. Judge Edward Blythen, a former Cleveland mayor, presided. As was expected of a trial set to rivet the nation, Hearst newspapers sent their celebrity reporter Dorothy Kilgallen to cover it. The judge, who had seen Kilgallen as a regular panelist on the TV show What's My Line, invited her to his chambers to chat with him. When Kilgallen mentioned that the whole thing was a mystery, Blythen responded by saying, "Mystery? It's an open and shut case." Meaning, of course, he thought Shepard was guilty. And he told this to a journalist before the trial was even over. Kilgallen couldn't believe a judge would voice that kind of opinion, and yet, because it hadn't been an on-the-record convo, she told no one. A decade later, she would tell the story and defend her bizarre decision to keep it private at the time by saying she considered the judge a confidential source. I mean, okay. Listen, I'm no journalist, but it seems to me you'd be forgiven for revealing a source when a man's life is at stake. But it wasn't just the judge who'd made up his mind, of course. Dr. Samuel Gerber, the coroner on the case, had run an exhaustive smear campaign, even without anything solid to smear Shepard with. When a t-shirt was discovered in a tangle of beach grass near the Shepard's home sometime after the murder, Dr. Gerber made a big brouhaha about how he now had the goods on Sam. He had told the reporters that it was a perfect match in brand and size for all of Sam's other t-shirts found in his drawers, Surely the t-shirt would prove Sam had murdered his wife. The shirt was tested for blood. None was found. Now Gerber was like, no, I never said it was definitely his shirt. I just said, like, maybe or whatever. Now he was telling press the shirt was merely the same size. Gerber also said a heavy, damaged flashlight found near the lake wasn't the murder weapon, the one described as having left round injuries on Marilyn's body, because he'd already decided the murder weapon was a surgical instrument. This fucking guy. And don't get me started on all the people who knew that Gerber was overreaching and didn't fucking pipe up. Even the prosecutors were annoyed with Gerber because he'd pushed hard to basically rip up the Shepherd's whole house looking for some evidence he was sure had to be hidden somewhere, instead of focusing on the actual death investigation. Police were also peeved at Gerber because while they were out actually looking for the suspect Shepherd had described, Gerber was like a horse with blinders on. And yet, despite their concerns over Gerber's conduct, it seems no one called for him to step down or be removed from the case. Wasn't anyone bothered that there might be a murderer on the loose? Where was their concern for the other women in the neighborhood? Why not worry about who else was out there breaking into people's houses, killing women while they lay in their beds? I can promise you, Cleveland women might have been convinced it was Sam, but they sure as shit locked their doors twice at night now. Indeed, two witnesses testified that they saw a bushy-haired man near the Shepherd home that morning. And remember, Shepherd said he was attacked by a bushy-haired man. The case against Dr. Shepherd was largely circumstantial. Despite Dr. Gerber's best efforts, investigators hadn't found any actual evidence to tie Sam to his wife's murder. Dr. Mary Cohen from the Trace Evidence Department in the coroner's office had done a lot of work that was hard, solitary drudgery. Author James Neff tells the story of how she found red fibers under Marilyn's fingernails and went back to the Shepherd house to test every piece of clothing in the house to see if it matched anything in their closets. It didn't. Likewise, she checked the clothes Sam wore the night or morning of the murder and found no blood on his socks or shoes. The only substantial blood she found was on his trousers and only at the knee, as if he'd kneeled in Marilyn's pooling blood at some point. Listen, I've never murdered anyone, nor have I discovered someone's beaten body, but something tells me, in either case, I probably would kneel down and see if they were indeed dead. Remember that despite how badly Marilyn had been beaten, it wasn't immediately obvious to the neighbor that she was dead. Plus, I would imagine a disoriented and terrified spouse would, upon finding their beloved in that condition, probably drop to their knees. They might even try to wake their spouse up, telling themselves, she's just sleeping, it's fine. The last thing I imagine we want to believe is that our loved one is dead. You know that scene in Contagion where the doctors tell Matt Damon that his wife is dead and he's like, yeah, okay, but can I go talk to her? It's like that. Known as a thorough scientist, Dr. Cohen nevertheless did not try to type the blood found on the stairs or on the glass door. She said there had not been enough blood to test. Not enough blood? Listen, I'm no phlebotomist, but I'm pretty sure there doesn't need to be a lot of blood to test for type. Maybe the technology at the time required a lot more than it does now, and maybe my idea of smears of blood is different than theirs. A smear suggests, you know, at least like as much mustard as you might put on a corned beef sandwich. That's not enough to test. Dr. Cohen added that it was likely already too old to test. There was all kinds of weird shit going on during the trial. For example, after Shepherd testified, police issued a press release calling Shepherd a bare-faced liar. The press somehow managed to accuse him of being sterile, implying that the baby Marilyn was carrying wasn't his, and that he kept decomposing heads in his garage. That escalated quickly. That last bit might have been funny if, after 5 days of deliberation, the jury hadn't found Dr. Shepard guilty of second-degree murder. Years later, jurors in the trial would admit to having been influenced by the media coverage of the case. And some admitted they just didn't like Sam Shepard. Not because of personal experience. One juror didn't like that they performed abortions at the hospital where Shepard worked. Another felt that the extramarital affairs gave him motive, even though he had never discussed long-term plans with any of the women he'd spent time with. Neither had he promised them anything or expressed any kind of hate toward his wife. Another juror simply thought him arrogant. Excellent reasons to find someone guilty of murder. Kilgallen wrote in her Daily Syndicated column that she was shocked by the verdict in the trial, which she had sat through every day. The only thing she could have convicted him of, she wrote, quote, was possible negligence in not locking his back door, end quote. It was Christmas time, and by way of gift, Dr. Sam Shepard was given life in prison. The home where the crime took place was released back to the family, still with blood on its walls and floors. 4 days later, Sam's mother, Ethel, died by suicide. His father, Richard, died 11 days after his mother. The official cause of death was stomach cancer, but I'm guessing there was probably some heartbreak peppered in there as well. On January 3, 1955, Judge Blythen denied Shepard a new trial despite the defense offering 40 different motions to do so on various grounds, all which they said precluded fairness. One of which, I have to imagine, was lack of evidence? The defense, with the money and the anger supplied by the Shepard family, had not rested after the 1955 verdict. Immediately after Sam was behind bars for what was believed to be forever, his defense attorney made a call and his remaining family agreed to pay a preeminent forensic scientist to do his own work inside the house. He would find what nobody else had. Paul Kirk, chair of criminalistics at the University of California, Berkeley, was kind of a big deal. He had worked on the Manhattan Project, which was itself a crime against humanity. He's considered among the pioneers of forensic science. His seminal book, Crime Investigation on the Burgeoning Field of Forensics, was even cited in Dr. Sam Shepard's trial. The Shepard family hired Kirk. He told them he had no opinion about the crime or who had done it. He was simply to marshal the facts, which was, of course, a courtesy not afforded Sam in the original investigation. Now, after 4 days of vacuuming, photographing, measuring, lifting prints, taking samples, and restaging the crime from inside the Shepard home, you know, the stuff that should have been done to begin with, Kirk was almost ready to compare what science said had happened to what Sam said had happened. He and his lab, full of eager and very bright students, did all kinds of fancy shit to draw that picture. They timed how long it took for blood to dry, they triangulated from Marilyn's body to the splatter to the bed and back again, and figured out the length of the instrument she was killed with. It was the size of a 3-cell flashlight, about 1 foot long. Similar, incidentally, to the one found on the shore of Lake Erie sometime after the murder. He examined Marilyn's broken teeth pattern and determined she had bitten whoever attacked her. Not only did he determine that the large splotch near the bedroom door was likely from that wound, he believed it also accounted for all the blood drops throughout the house. In April 1955, the Shepherds received a 19-page, single-spaced explanation of Kirk's methodology and findings. It was all there. Marilyn had been killed by someone other than her husband. Sam had been hit by the same object as Marilyn had, and that, quote, by no stretch of the imagination can it be conceived that the injuries to the defendant were self-inflicted, end quote. Remember, Sam's face was beaten. Two of his teeth were chipped, and his neck was injured enough that it had required a brace. Upon examination, it was found he sustained a concussion, permanent nerve damage on the left side of his face, and damaged vertebrae. You're telling me he beat himself so hard he did all that? And listen, let's say he did have a motive to kill his wife, which again, the prosecution never provided. Dr. Sam Shepard was a good-looking, successful doctor who frequently cheated on his wife. Do we really believe he would have willingly maimed his own face to stage this crime? Immediate motions were made for a new trial based on the new findings. But the Ohio Appeals Court wasn't having it. Neither was any other court in the land. Motions for appeal were denied all the way up to the Supreme Court. The appeals process for Dr. Sam Shepard was at a standstill for some 4 years, until in early November 1959, Richard Dick Eberling from Dick's Window Cleaning, a popular vendor in the area, was nabbed for robbing money from inside a house in the affluent Cleveland neighborhood on the lake. Dick, it turns out, had been collecting all kinds of things from inside people's homes for a while, favoring silver, jewelry, and money, but really anything that he could slip into his soapy bucket and carry out undetected. 5 years earlier, it just so happened, he'd washed windows for Marilyn Shepard. His name had been clearly marked as a receipt of pay in her checkbook. Sam's sister-in-law, Dorothy, had hired Dick sometime in 1957 and claimed he found it appropriate to tell Dorothy how hot Marilyn had been. She said he'd said, quote, "Oh, she had that California look. Tight little brief shorts and very little blouse. She was immaculate, all in white." End quote. Gross. Listen, I had a window salesman here the other day who explained how he'd proven beyond a doubt the existence of God that no one else had ever come up with before, because how did a stick bug know how to disguise itself as a stick? I mean, if that's not a solid argument against evolution, I don't know what is. But my point is, some things are just not appropriate for a vendor to talk about on a sales call. The existence of God in a house completely lacking in religious iconography is one. How fuckable someone's dead sister-in-law was is also one. Anyway, when the cops nabbed Dick, the window washer, they found Marilyn's jewelry in his possession. What? Proof positive he'd been inside the Shepherd home and stolen something. Well, actually, no. The jewelry box had been kept at Sam's brother's house since the murder. Dick, it turns out, had stolen them from there. There'd been a whole slew of robberies of this kind in and around the area, and Dick copped to all of them. One of the detectives asked Dr. Gerber to polygraph Dick about Marilyn's murder. Sure, why not get the guy who decided the husband was guilty within hours of the murder to polygraph a viable suspect? Gerber declined. What a shock. Bay Village police went ahead with it. Dick claimed he did not know who killed Marilyn. He said he had injured himself once inside Sam and Marilyn's home, and there might be blood evidence that could connect him to the house, but, you know, not the murder. And with that, Dick, who'd confessed to all those larcenies and to bleeding inside the home of a murdered woman, got 3 months in jail and a $300 fine. And then, in 1961, a lawyer named F. Lee Bailey, he of the Boston Strangler case fame, which would come later, came to town. I'm going to skip a lot of how he got involved in the case, but suffice to say he was young, hungry, smart, and really interested in polygraph tests as they related to legal procedure. Suffice it also to say that he was out to make a name for himself, which he most certainly did, and this case looked like a pretty smart express ticket to success. Soon enough, Bailey and the Shepherd brothers were talking to the national media about Sam's case, and how the now best-selling book Retrial, Murder and Dr. Sam Shepard by crime writer and Chicago Tribune reporter Paul Holmes was helping to point the finger at someone else. Bailey worked every angle, and in 1964, Sam was released after District Court Judge Carl Wenman ruled that Sam's 1954 trial was a mockery of justice and ordered that he be freed. In his ruling, he wrote, quote, "If ever there was a trial by newspaper, this is a perfect example. And the most insidious example was the Cleveland Press. For some reason, that newspaper took upon itself the role of accuser, judge, and jury," end quote. The Ohio Supreme Court disagreed with the district court, but Bailey took the case back to the Supreme Court, who'd apparently had a change of heart, and with an 8-1 majority agreed that Dr. Shepard deserved a new trial because his 14th Amendment had been trampled on like a herd of rhinos. They didn't actually mention rhinos, but I thought I would. What they actually ruled was that the publicity surrounding the trial prejudiced Shepard's right to a fair trial by an impartial jury. That much was pretty obvious. 2 days later, the Cuyahoga County prosecutors said they'd try Shepard again for the crime. In late fall of 1966, Dr. Sam Shepard's second trial got rolling with better forensic experts and without the crush of press that accompanied his first trial. This time, the jury would be sequestered, because, duh. As University of Missouri law professor Douglas Linder noted in his lengthy exposition of the case, Dr. Gerber was not the star of this trial this time around, and Bailey got him to admit he'd hunted all over the country to find any surgical instrument that could have possibly inflicted the wounds that killed Marilyn. Needless to say, he did not. This time, Dr. Shepard was found not guilty. But of course, the new verdict didn't bring back Sam Shepard's wife, Marilyn, or his parents, and the damage to his reputation had been done. A lot of people in the court of public opinion figured he'd simply beaten the rap. You know, white man, family money, great lawyer, works every time. To make matters worse, his second wife, whom he'd married in 1964, divorced him in 68. A family of one of his patients sued him for wrongful death, and he finally quit his medical practice. Sam Shepard was understandably bitter. The once highly successful and desirable doctor had to resort to working as a wrestler, whose stage name was The Killer. Yes, you heard that right. He even invented a new chokehold move called mandible claw. He married for a third time, this time to the very young daughter of his wrestling manager. Listen, I don't know that I would ever be able to marry a person who'd been suspected of murdering their wife. Unless the murder was on video and very clearly not done by the person in question, that's just not an accusation I would be able to brush off. Sam's wrestling career and third marriage lasted only 6 months. Dr. Sam Shepard, aka professional wrestler The Killer, died in 1970 when he was just 46 of liver disease as he had resorted to alcohol, which I find completely understandable, if tragic. And stranger, if this story sounds familiar, minus the professional wrestling part, it's because A, you are a true crime buff, and or B, it sounds a lot like the plot of the extremely popular 1967 TV series and 1993 movie, The Fugitive.
I didn't kill my wife! I don't care!
God damn, that's a good movie. If you haven't seen it, stop what you're doing immediately and go watch it. Actually, as per usual, wait until you finish listening and then go watch it. I promise it will not disappoint. Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones are both at their primes. Plus, the woman who played one half of one of the sweetest couples ever seen on television, L. Scott Caldwell, aka Rose, on Lost. The difference between the fictional and IRL versions is the conspiracy plot about corrupt pharmaceutical stoolies, a one-armed man, and, of course, Tommy Lee Jones. Where was I? Thank you. There was, of course, at least one other victim of the heinous murder of Marilyn Shepherd. Her son, Samuel Reese Chip Shepherd, who'd only been 7 years old when he lost his mother to murder, his grandparents shortly thereafter, and his father to a speedy and very partial trial and its devastating aftermath. And there was, of course, still the outstanding issue of bringing the actual perpetrator of the murder to justice. For more than 3 decades, Sam Jr. listened to his family's stories being told by other people, in the press, in books, on television, and in the movies, until he decided to take control of the narrative. It was late 1989 when Samuel Reese Shepherd, now a dental hygienist and an anti-death penalty activist, scheduled a speech at the City Club in Cleveland where he announced, quote, "In this city last month, a career criminal who has association with my family 35 years ago was sentenced to life in prison on an unrelated murder charge. I have reason to believe that this individual conspired with others in the murder of my mother," end quote. He was talking about Richard Dick Eberling. He didn't have a lot of proof, but suspicions surrounded him. Dick had been around quite a number of people, mostly women, who had mysteriously died. Specifically, his foster father, a nurse he was dating, a woman named Myrtle Frey, who died in 1962, and her sister, Ethel Mae Durkin, who died a year later. And I can't skip over the fact that Ethel and Myrtle have to be the most quintessentially old-timey American names of all time. I think it's time to bring them back. Anyway, it was Ethel's murder that would finally send Dick to prison. Sam Jr. got the ball rolling, albeit very slowly, to reopen his mother's case. 6 years later, attorney Terry Gilbert forced the Bay Village Police Department to open up its Shepherd files. Gilbert told the producers of the TV series Lake Erie Murders, quote, "We have the tools now to look for evidence, removing from the equation all the circumstantial evidence, the speculation, the character assassinations, and let's have science look at this objectively," end quote. They did, and using some of Paul Kirk's original work and other more recent work, third-party blood, that's blood that is neither Marilyn's nor Sam's, showed up in the bedroom, on the stairs, and on the porch. Because of course it did. Further, a trace of sperm was found in Marilyn's vagina that was not Sam's. Because of course it did. Further investigation linked the blood and semen to, yes, local handyman Richard Dick Eberling. County Assistant Prosecutor Carmen Marino looked at the new evidence Chip's team had put together and concluded, quote, "I don't think Sam Shepherd killed his wife," end quote. The prosecutor's office was set to reopen the case. But by then it was 1997 and prosecutor Stephanie Tubbs Jones was getting a lot of pushback from local law enforcement who didn't want their reputation sullied by dredging up a poorly investigated case, even if it had been nearly 40 years ago. Jones was looking to run for higher office in the upcoming election and didn't want to risk the political fallout, so she denied Chip's request to reopen the case. Dick Eberling died in prison in 1998. Sam Jr.'s fight for justice went on for more than 20 years, complete with exhumations, civil trials, dismissed trials, settlements, and appeals. As of 2002, the last appeal on civil trial got thrown out. A lot of people disagree over not only the basic details of the case or who is or is not culpable, but it seems basic legal operations and rules. Reading through the timeline is an exercise in patience and cognitive gymnastics. I wouldn't recommend it without a nap and a snack first. Or maybe that's just me. I'm not a smart man, Jenny. Sam Chip Shepherd, I imagine, still wants justice. But with Dick Eberling never charged in Marilyn's murder and now dead, it is likely impossible that Dr. Sam Shepherd will ever truly be cleared of all suspicion. Ultimately, though, justice isn't for Dr. Sam Shepherd, it's for Marilyn. She deserves to have the truth told. She, and frankly, her imperfect husband, deserve to rest in peace. Thank you. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, a tale so twisted it will leave you wondering what's what and who's who. The White Witch of Rose Hall. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by me and Amy Wilson, who also did the research. Editing help from Amber Hunt and sound engineering and mixing by Henry Lavoie. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you'll get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you'll get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. There's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. If you don't like the show, the name of the podcast is The Kevin Roberts Show. Stay strange.